Ambry presents Next and Now, a podcast on all things genetic.
Good morning or good afternoon, everyone, depending on where you're joining us from. My name is Christy Moore. I'm a genetic counselor here at Ambry. I'd like to thank you all for joining us for our one-hour educational webinar entitled Analyzing Historical Mutations in the CFTR Gene Reveals a High Number of Reclassified Variants. In this presentation, we will review cystic fibrosis as well as an in-depth summary of variant classification, especially as it relates to CFTR and some of the specific challenges in classifying variants within this gene. We will also discuss data that were presented at last year's ACMG meeting that details our institutional approach to classifying variants, what we found, and how this can impact clinical practice. So now it is my pleasure to introduce our two speakers today. First, we have Kendra Waller. Ms. Waller completed her BS in Cell and Molecular Genetics from Texas Tech University. She received her MS from the University of Texas Houston's Health Science Center in 2001, where she participated in research at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Prior to her graduate work, Ms. Waller served as a research technician for the Human Genome Project at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. After earning her MS, she worked as a prenatal genetic counselor in multiple cities in Texas, Florida, and California until 2011 when she joined Ambry Genetics. Since joining Ambry, Ms. Waller has participated in research and development of available respiratory, gastrointestinal, and bone marrow failure testing options, as well as implementation of variant classification guidelines. Our second presenter is Jade Tinker. Ms. Tinker graduated from Southwestern University with a BS in animal behavior. She then completed her MS in genetic counseling from the University of Utah. Her graduate project involved prevalence of autistic traits in children with neurofibromatosis type 1. Ms. Tinker taught biology classes at a community college in Dallas, Texas, and did contract work with Illumina prior to joining Ambry. Thank you, ladies, both for presenting to us today. Kendra, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christy, and thank you, everyone, for taking time today to join us for this presentation. Today, we're going to discuss some changes in the molecular community and how advances in technology have impacted how we classify alterations that we find in the CFTR gene. So our goals today are to review the criteria we use for classification of alterations we see, discuss implications of genetic counseling and health application using CFTR as an example to some of the challenges classification schemes must overcome, then how we've taken this process and found to reclassify alterations through a retrospective analysis in the CFTR gene. But first, I'd like to briefly review cystic fibrosis and the molecular knowledge of the CFTR gene, which you'll see presents some difficulties when we attempt to determine what an alteration can potentially do. So CFTR was first identified to be the causative gene for cystic fibrosis in three papers. All of them were published in 1989. It is in the family of the ATP binding cassette membrane transporters, which these proteins require quite a bit of energy to overcome the homeostasis between inside the cell and outside the cell. The proteins pretty much force their respective molecules to traverse the membrane against this equalizing of concentration. So CFTR does with mainly chloride, but it also does it with sodium and bicarbonate as well. So a brief description and review of some of the classical symptoms we can see in CF. This is definitely not a comprehensive review. That information could be its own presentation all in itself. So the most common and well-known are the pulmonary manifestations, the respiratory symptoms, and the frequent lung infections. We also see chronic sinusitis and nasal polyps, and alterations in the CFTR gene have also been linked to bronchiectasis. We can also see elevated sweat chloride levels of over 60. This is considered highly suggestive of cystic fibrosis. And there's also this middle or intermediate range between 40 and 60 that actually causes quite a challenge for diagnosing a patient. Then the pancreatic function is frequently impaired in the more severe cases, and this can lead to diabetes or other complications. And there's actually a 5% lifetime risk of CF-related diabetes in this population. Also, newborns and infants, they can also present with meconium ileus or growth retardation due to poor absorption in the nutrients in the gut. But I'd like to also talk about CFTR-related disorders. One is congenital absence of the vas deferens. This is typically bilateral, but some studies suggest unilateral may also have a higher association with mutations. Then there's pancreatitis. So both idiopathic chronic pancreatitis and recurrent acute pancreatitis has been studied extensively. Most clinicians do agree that CFTR mutations are associated as well. The theory of how CFTR is related to pancreatitis is thought to be the bicarbonate transport function of the CFTR gene. This is very closely linked to the chloride channel function. Approximately 15 to 35% of patients with pancreatitis have a disease-causing alteration. Then there has been an established association with the development of bronchiectasis with mutations in the CFTR gene. All of these CFTR-related disorders present a significant challenge to this daunting task of determining the pathogenicity of an alteration. So CFTR is set up within the membrane. It has two symmetrical halves, each comprising a membrane-spanning domain and a nucleotide-binding domain, then connected by a large regulatory domain. So here you can see this membrane, you know, spanning domain. It's snaking up and down, and it creates this kind of tunnel that continuously pumps the chloride out of the cell matrix into the extracellular matrix. And so here's our nucleotide binding domain. It's binding ATP to give this channel a pumping ability. And this big bundle is our regulatory domain. This uses different molecules as a feedback loop to control when will the ATP bind, which then controls the channel as well. So when we find alterations, sometimes depending on the domain it is, we actually use that as a starting point to how would this alteration affect function. But it's not just the function that we're actually worried about. Here's a schematic in a linear form, and you can see the symmetry easier. So here we have the two nucleotide binding domains, and these cylinder-looking things, these are membrane-spanning domains connected by links. And here's our large regulatory domain. This brings up other issues that actually lead to deleterious changes. So not only are we worried about how these alterations affect function and the structure, we also worry whether or not CFTR ever gets transcribed in the first place, or even translated to the protein, or if it's even processed correctly, and then whether or not it even gets into the membrane in the first place. So all of these steps are actually needed to even do its function as a protein. So you would think that given there are several identified domains that there must be hotspots in this gene, right? But you would be wrong. So this diagram nicely summarizes the simple point that there are no hotspots. So below these exon numbering, you can see the locations of the different types of alterations that were listed on the left. Some of these alterations are known mutations, but some are still uncertain here or known to be benign. But I'm very thankful that the cystic fibrosis database actually marked all of these changes into this nice, concise format. It actually illustrates pretty well that the location of a change is actually not a good indicator of the pathogenicity of a change in CFTR. So I'll be mentioning two of the alterations only, and these just demonstrate some points we have to consider. And the first is Delta F508, the most common mutation in the population, and our frequency of it ranges anywhere from 80% for certain European populations to as rare as 5% in Native American populations. So if we know the frequency of Delta F508 in each powerful, this can be powerful information to help with the classification because we can leverage this frequency with the frequency of other variants to use as evidence to actually create something to be benign. And then I'd like to bring up the poly-T track. This demonstrates another point. So this is a repeat of thymidine bases located in intron 10, which used to be called intron 8. And the 5T allele increases skipping of exon 10, but the 7T and the 9T allele are considered polymorphisms. And then the TG tract is closely located upstream of the poly-T and can have 11, 12, or 13 repeat links. And the length of the TG tract modifies the effect of the 5T exon skipping. It's a modifier of a modifier. The changes 5T and TG track is commonly found in cysts with R117H, and we can see possible symptoms that can occur if the 5T is in trans with another mutation. So our knowledge of these modifiers actually makes the community a little more aware that not every alteration is actually clear-cut. If we apply some rigid classification schemes, this change actually might be considered likely benign instead of a modifier. So then what we tell the patient can actually be incorrect. So with the background of cystic fibrosis and CFTR reviewed, I'm going to jump subjects to variant classification. So the variant is a genetic alteration or change, but this word does not have any clinical meaning or significance. It is just a descriptive term, but we do need to subdivide these variants into clinically significant categories through developed classification models. So all sequence-based tests could identify a variant of unknown significance, and with full gene analysis of the CFTR gene, we are running across more and more of these types of variants. When we use variant classification schemes, we actually use lines of evidence to determine how this variant contributes to clinical presentation. For example, so do we diagnose a child with a certain disorder because there's a variant in this certain gene? Is this variant even causing the disease? What's the likelihood that it is? We get many questions of this sort. So the ultimate goal of a classification model is to take a variant or a change and determine with evidence, does it cause disease or does it not cause disease? It would be great if these are the only two options, but as we all know, genetics is a world of gray, so schemes today have many more options than just these two. So you're going to hear the term lines of evidence throughout this presentation. Basically, each piece of information we find is considered a separate piece of evidence to apply to a variant. So we collect all these lines and apply to some algorithm or set of rules, and we generate a classification at the end of it. So here are some examples of lines of evidence commonly used. So at the top, you'll see published literature, and this is the most heavily weighted in the form of functional assays, case reports, and case control studies. We can use databases. This includes population frequency databases and disease and mutation-based databases as well. On the left side, we use in silico models, both the missense-based models like Polyfin and SIF, or some of the splicing models that are out there. Although we can't weight these as heavily as they're simply theoretical models. And then the bottom, we have internal data. Each lab has its own set of data to apply. Of course, the more labs that participate and share data, the more powerful this evidence. So family studies with co-segregation can be powerful if there's enough family members. Then other mutations we find with our unknown variants, along with this phenotype and clinical data, this all can be applied as another line of evidence. This is probably a good time now to mention that providing clinical information on your patient to a lab is incredibly helpful. It contributes so much right now that recent guidelines are starting to push this practice to become common. Because if we don't have this clinical information on a patient, there is a very real possibility that we could be missing a chance to classify this variant. So I'd like to introduce you to some of the classification schemes that are already published. They're available for the application in some cases. So the International Agency for the Research on Cancer, IARC, published this classification scheme for various cancer genes. It has a five-tier classification system with the probabilities being applied to the classes that you can see on the right-hand side. Their scheme benefits from this mathematical computation. They can actually make based on current knowledge that they found in the literature, so things like segregation in families, their cumulative lifetime risk in family members in the population, and some tumor presentations that have an established clinical sensitivity to a certain gene. So this benefit allows a quantitative way to present data to the clinician. The definitely pathogenic and likely pathogenic variant classification are considered clinically actionable, and this leaves the remaining classifications to default back to the clinical presentation of the patient. The limitation with this one is that it's specifically for the more common cancer genes, and these genes have a great deal of information behind it. The European Cystic Fibrosis Society published some guidelines back in 2008, but really what I want to point out here is the A and B classification. This classification scheme actually attempts to take into account the variability of the CF phenotype. So it differentiates from classic CF disease and CFTR-related disorders. So this is something that still presents a challenge for classification schemes for any gene that has a variable presentation. And then there's the CFTR2 project, which is available online to search and includes all of this data to classify variants. And the phenotype analysis is actually limited to just the classic CF presentation rather than the more variable CFTR-related disorders. They also use functional analysis, both from studies previously performed in the literature, and they conducted their own studies as well. So they conduct splicing functional studies, maturation studies, this determines the processing of the protein, chloride current measurements, this determines the function of the protein, and then penetrance analysis. Then they developed this algorithm, and it helps classify a certain number of variants that they found, and it puts them into three different classes. In the bottom, you see these colored boxes. So on the left-hand side, these are the variants that are considered CF-causing. Again, remember, they're defining this as classic CF. On the very right-hand side, you see these are non-CF-causing, and right in the middle, they have this indeterminate. So it's more of a three-tier system they're presenting. And then hot off the presses, the American College of Medical Genetics and the Association for Molecular Pathology just posted January 20th, this past Tuesday, their guidelines for variant classification. And it does take into account that clinical laboratories gave some feedback. So you can actually go into the ACMG website. You can view a copy of it now, and I recommend viewing the guidelines because it has a thorough discussion of the caveats, of the exceptions, and the limitations to the guidelines. It also gives a really nice list of in silico models and mutation databases and disease databases. So we are very excited this has finally become public. And so this guideline proposes a five-tier system and uses language similar to other classification schemes. And the term likely pathogenic and the likely benign actually indicates a greater than 90% chance that this variant is pathogenic or benign. Of course, this is really an arbitrary number, and these categories are compiled with all this known data we can find on a variant. So ACMG scheme first inserts a line of evidence into pathogenic or benign. And so the idea is to take a line of evidence and assign it to one of them, like the very strong pathogenic evidence. Then each category here is weighted and goes through this algorithm to classify it. So, okay, probably not the best way to read this information, but it's meant as a kind of algorithm, the set of rules for each line of evidence you gather. So, for example, under likely pathogenic, number two, we have one strong pathogenic evidence and two of moderate pathogenic evidence. This would classify it as a likely pathogenic classification. And it's repeatedly stated in these guidelines that expert judgment should be used to help weigh the evidence as well. For example, if there are several individuals with a variant that have classic disease, a lab can actually consider that line of evidence a little bit stronger. So here comes the challenges with CFTR. These should be noted when trying to determine if an alteration can cause disease or not. So I'm bringing up this diagram again and want to highlight case reports and case control studies here. These studies are actually highly dependent on how the population was defined. Was the population classical CF? Was it CFTR-related disorders only? Is this population actually defined as everything that we see? So we need to determine how this line of evidence, when we look at these, should be applied. So given the differences between the classical presentation and the CFTR-related disorders, it's never really straightforward how to put a variant into like an all-encompassing scheme. A lot of studies get around this. They clarify that they're only studying how a variant causes classic disease, but not the other related disorders. The problem is that clinical labs, even like ours, we get different indications for testing CFTR, so including these related disorders. So when we find a variant, even if it doesn't meet criteria to cause the classic disease, that still doesn't rule out it's not associated with the related disorder. So more thought needs to go into the development of these schemes. So this is definitely still a work in progress. Now I'd like to point out further challenges we've come across, and that is of the published literature out there for this gene. So given this gene was first published way back in 1989, there is a wealth of articles available for review, but the amount of articles actually becomes quite the hurdle. First, one individual can be reported several times in the literature because the same lab is continually adding to its population or studying different things. There's also a significant clinical collaboration between labs, and each of them publish a study. Then also we're looking at published literature being a victim of the current understanding at that time. So a lot of this historical literature was written before the variant classification models were even designed. So at the time, sequencing was still in its infancy and variation rate between people was barely understood. So although allele frequency literature for different ethnic groups is useful for population data, a lot of times the publication didn't define what the clinical symptoms of their population were. And then information on the phase, how it was determined, this is often lacking. Because if a variant is in cis with a mutation, we're looking as evidence for benign. But if it's in trans, then we're looking at evidence for pathogenic. And then most genes have had nomenclature changes over the years. CFTR is no exception. So you have to be mindful of the nomenclature used at the time of this publication. And then I'd also like to go into internal data. There are definitely some challenges using internal data, even with the large amount of samples. We can have definitely some lacking information. So co-segregation is investigating if this variant is tracking with disease. In autosomal recessive cases, though, we need large families with more than one affected family member, and these are kind of rare. Phase information is important, but typically that's the only family data we have at all. So in order to reclassify a variant, several families with phase information need to be analyzed. And then many times, various family members also send their samples to different labs. So if the labs aren't aware of other family members, some valuable co-segregation data can be missed. Given that this gene has a lot of family-specific mutations, this is a significant limitation. Again, clinical data is lacking. I think a vast majority of CFTR variants are missing some significant line of evidence because of this. But all is not lost. We have the Hardy-Weinberg law, and this Hardy-Weinberg equation, it's a pretty robust tool we can use for autosomal recessive disorders. We can now use variant frequency from these public available population databases, and we can apply it to the Hardy-Weinberg equation. We can see if the variant is too common to cause disease or if it is not, you know, it could be possibly disease-causing. It's a real powerful line of evidence. The limitation of this application is that the variant has to be seen in the databases in the first place. But this is a tool that can move a variant to the benign class, but not as useful for bumping a variant up to the pathogenic status. So this graph actually illustrates how we can leverage this delta F508 frequency, specifically in the Caucasian population, but we can apply it to other variants that we find. So this is a simplified version. So all mutations that cause disease occur in 2% of alleles. Delta F508 occurs in 1.3% of alleles. So subtract that, and what we get is a predicted frequency of all other mutations being 0.7%. So in essence, we have lowered our frequency threshold for possible mutations. This makes it easier for a variant to be considered too common and likely benign. But again, there's some caveats to using the Hardy-Weinberg law. First, there must be random mating in the population. Second, this chart really applies only to Caucasians. And then third, the carrier's reproductive ability must not be compromised. But given male CFTR carriers can have CBAVD, a classification scheme really needs to account for this possibility because this law doesn't fit perfectly to CFTR. So in the news, so a few years ago, a story circulated of a boy by the name of Coleman Chadman who had alterations in the CFTR gene. He wasn't allowed to enroll in his local elementary school because there was another child already attending that had cystic fibrosis. All right, this is a copy of the CDC recommendation for cystic fibrosis. This is not meant for you to actually read. This is really just to make the point that there are an extensive amount of recommendations for kids with CF when they're attending school. The guidelines are centered around separating the two individuals as much as you can. So this includes a minimum of 6 feet. They need to be in separate classrooms. They need to be at separate lunch tables and separate buses. So in this case, the school is just attempting to do what's best for these kids to prevent the spread of lung infections. There were two statements in the news story I found interesting, although not really surprising. One was Coleman carries the genetic mutations for cystic fibrosis, and in the next paragraph, Coleman's parents argue that their son's doctor has confirmed that the boy doesn't have the disease and therefore isn't a risk to other students. So I'm sure all of us in the genetic field are familiar with the lay press, again, confusing the public. Now, I'm not involved in this case, but it does bring up a question. So if an individual was tested a number of years ago and two alterations were found and they were claimed to be pathogenic, I would think a good physician would probably counsel the patient that there is a likelihood that the child has cystic fibrosis and we need to keep an eye out on symptoms. So the parents are coming away from this counseling session under the impression that their child has CF, but just no symptoms yet. However, what if those mutations or alterations are really variants of unknown significance or associated with CFTR-related disorders or even likely benign alterations today, this issue wouldn't even become newsworthy. So if a child gets misdiagnosed, then these lifestyle changes are placed on the family and they can be hard to follow. So accurate classification is completely integral to patient care. But there is a happy ending. The parents went through the court system, and eventually the child could be enrolled in his local elementary school, and then everybody lived happily ever after. So, but now I'd like to introduce Jade. Jade is going to speak about Ambry's experience with classifying variants in CFTR. So I'll let Jade take over now.
Thanks, Kendra, for that great overview of CF variant classification and some of the challenges CF can pose when it comes to assessing alterations in the CFTR gene. So I'm going to talk more specifically about how CFTR variant classification works here at Ambry and our experience with it so far. Ambry was the first to offer full CFTR gene sequencing back in 2000. And later to offer deletion duplication testing as well. This long history with CFTR sequencing provides us with a large database of CFTR alterations. In 2013, a classification scheme specific to CFTR was created and implemented based on some of the guidelines Kendra discussed earlier. Using this new classification scheme, over 150 alterations have been classified as a variant of unknown significance at this time. And in some cases, these alterations were reclassified from a different classification down to a VUS. I would like to note that alterations are reassessed as we see them in current patients. So this number doesn't capture some of those older alterations that are really rare and we haven't seen in a long time. That being said, clinicians can always call and ask for a reassessment of an older CFTR alteration. In 2014, we had a poster presentation accepted at ACMG that shared our experience with this new classification scheme. What we found was many alterations previously reported in the literature and by laboratories as mutations didn't really have the evidence to back up that classification. Our classification scheme uses the same five-tiered classification outlined by the ACMG guidelines and that Kendra discussed earlier in the presentation. Here is the classification scheme that we created for CFTR with the various lines of evidence we consider and how they are weighted. We have weighted these lines of evidence similar to the guidelines published by ACMG previously, and those are the same guidelines that were updated earlier this week. This picture of the scheme may be difficult to read. However, if you go to our website, you can pull up our poster presentation under Research and Collaboration, Scientific Posters, and then down under ACMG 2014. After the implementation of our CFTR classification scheme, we performed a retrospective analysis through March of 2011 of alterations that were reported as mutations. All of these alterations were identified via Sanger sequencing or next generation sequencing. A total of 277 mutations were evaluated using this scheme at the time of the poster. We applied our classification scheme to alterations that were classified previously as mutations to see if they met our new criteria for pathogenic mutation. These alterations were previously classified as mutations based on databases, which are often not very well curated, and older literature, which, as Kendra mentioned earlier, often considered any change to be deleterious. Older studies also tend to be incomplete when it comes to methodology. Many studies perform mutation panels or sequence only certain exons of the gene, or they may not have included deletion duplication studies. We found that 104, or 37.5%, of alterations previously classified as mutations were reclassified to a variant or lower. 26 historical mutations were reclassified to variant, likely pathogenic. The majority of reclassified alterations were reclassified to variant of unknown significance. That was 73 out of the 104. 16 of the historical mutations were classified as VUS due to conflicting data. 45 had insufficient evidence to remain a mutation, and 12 did not meet any criteria at all, meaning that there was limited data available on them. 4 alterations were reclassified to variant likely benign, and 1 historical mutation was reclassified all the way to benign. This was based both on population frequency and internal data. Here is a visual representation of all of the alterations that were assessed and how they were reclassified based on our new classification scheme. While the majority remained a mutation, a significant number were reclassified to a lower classification. To wrap up, I'd like to say that there are a lot of different types of evidence that should be considered when assessing a variant, such as functional data, co-occurrence with other pathogenic mutations, population frequency, co-segregation with disease, internal data, and in silico models. It's also important to read the literature with a critical eye. Given the historic nature of CFTR, many alterations were automatically deemed pathogenic without much evidence to support that classification. By applying guidelines like those provided by ACMG and standardized classification schemes such as the one we created here, we can provide a more accurate assessment of the pathogenicity of a variant. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you again, everyone, for joining us today. I also would like to announce that we do have another educational opportunity coming up next month. On February 25th, we will be presenting Getting to the Heart of the Matter, an overview of cardiovascular genetics. This will be a very informative look at cardiogenetics, and it's mainly geared toward genetic counselors or other medical professionals who don't have a very strong background or much familiarity with cardiovascular genetics. So it's going to be a very interesting and helpful presentation. So please keep an eye out for that announcement. Again, thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you very much, ladies, and thank you to all of our attendees. Have a great day.
This has been an Ambry Genetics production of Next and Now. To learn more, visit ambrygen.com.